Dolly 2 in painting for the first time. I was just like, you know, this is what I want. And I was like, holy crap, the lens flare is right. Holy crap, the shadow directions are light. Holy crap, it understands the context of the scene and is able to sort of like, you know, model those reflections, primary light directions, and, you know, the tonality and all this stuff goes from like 3-4 hours to 1 minute.
I'm with Bilaval Sidhu, an innovator at the intersection of 3D graphics and AI who's built an audience of over 1 million fans on YouTube and TikTok, teaching us all about the next generation of creativity. Can you tell me about what excites you most about today's technology and what it offers the world of creators? And welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me, John. It's great to be here. And what a time to be a creator. What excites me? I would say a couple things. Certainly the democratization of technology across the board, of the ability to capture immaculate visuals, both in 2D and 3D. And then this recent rise in generative AI, which allows us to take these captures of reality, reskin them, augment them, without needing, you know, this like ill-tailored tapestry of VFX and 3D tools and sort of this like really esoteric expertise that you've had to build. So the ability to go from like a vision in your head to a piece of content on whatever canvas you like, whether that's photo, video, and soon 3D, that's incredibly exciting to me. I can't imagine there being a better time to be a creative.
Awesome. So we're going to cover a lot of topics in this. So I want to talk about 3D graphics and NeRFs and photogrammetry and the whole generative pipeline that you've done. I want to talk about the intersection of AR. I'm going to start with like how I actually first got to know a little bit about your work, which was really only about a month or two ago when I saw this amazing room that you put online. I think you said it was your parents' house. You took some images of your parents' living room or something, and you then were able to apply generative AI to that to give us different versions of what that room would look like. And it was really amazing. Can you talk a little bit about the process you went through and what you were hoping to do creatively with that?
For sure. Yeah. That was actually one of my first sort of in quotes viral pieces on Twitter. And really the origin, the genesis of the idea was, you know, I've been into photogrammetry and reality capture for a long time. And, you know, generative AI has been very interesting to me. And, but what predominantly people have been doing in this space is text to image, right? You type in a text prompt and you get a bunch of images out there. But what if you've got, you know, a far more specific set of like creative guidelines in mind, right? Like what if there's an exact camera angle, you know, scene with imbued with dimensionality that you want to reskin effectively in a way. So the question I was asking myself is, how do I reskin a 3D capture of the real world and do that using generative AI? And so right around that time, you know, which is honestly not that long ago, late last year, Stable Diffusion came out with depth to image as a part of Stable Diffusion 2.0. And sort of the idea was, rather than just doing crude image to image, you can now provide this depth map, right? This depth map is this like grayscale image that encapsulates the distance of every pixel from the camera viewpoint. And you can use that to guide this diffusion process and sort of tame the chaos, if you will. And so the experiment was quite simple. It's like, hey, I had this 3D scan of my parents' house. This is right before they were like moving to another location. So, you know, being the photogrammetry nerd that I am, I went and like captured the whole house, of course. And so I had this living room or drawing room, as my mother likes to call it, that has this like rustic Indian decor. And so I took that, you know, used reality capture to turn it into a photogrammetry model. And then I had a very simple animation, sort of toggling the camera from like facade to facade, from position to position in the space. And then I was able to use the depth map that you can get from these type of things and pipe that into Stable Diffusion along with a reasonable prompt to essentially reskin it. And, you know, maybe a little extra secret sauce there was using Ebsynth to do cleaner interpolation. So I picked a couple of keyframes across that, you know, across the piece, and then was able to use Ebsynth, which incidentally doesn't use ML yet. They're working on an ML-based version, but this non-ML-based approach to just propagate the pixels across the sort of intermediate keyframes. And the result was quite fascinating. It's like, you know, you can do some really interesting things. And when you layer in, you know, fast forward a couple months after that, ControlNet came out, which was not just depth, but you could also layer in things like edge maps, which were amazing for this particular scenario because, hey, like the dimensionality of the furniture is nicely encapsulated in the depth map, but you've also got flat walls. There's no perceivable depth there, right? And so with edge detection, you could find all the paintings on the wall. So then I was able to like sort of combine the best of depth to image and this canny approach and control net together to create a pretty cool result. What was most funny to me is, and this just goes to show the strength of these diffusion models, my mom was like, hey, some of the paintings that got swapped out were actually timely and like regionally accurate. And I was like, whoa, like that's kind of cool. Like this is, you know, this is just, you know, there's enough information embedded in these images. So when you do, when you do the image to image plus control net and stable diffusion, you can get a stylistically accurate, you know, a freaking reskinning of a space. So that was the end-to-end process there.
Let's drill into some of the parts of that. So it seems like, you know, you've kind of chained together a whole bunch of different tools, which is, it's still a little bit complicated, but the very first part of that is photogrammetry in this. And it seems to me that photogrammetry is still really complicated, usually requires most of the time decent equipment. You get these big point clouds. What are your thoughts about where photogrammetry goes from here versus some of these newer technologies that we're starting to hear about, like neural radiance fields, NeRFs?
It's a great question. Yeah, it's like, you know, photogrammetry has been around, you know, since before computers, right? It's like sort of the art and science of measuring stuff in the world using images and increasingly other sensors like LiDAR, right? Yeah, it's insane. Like photogrammetry, while it's hard, even that's been quite democratized. If you think about, like, you know, let's go back to 2011. It was only companies like Google and Apple and Microsoft that could, you know, afford the compute that you needed and sort of the very specialized, you know, aerial capture systems that you needed to create 3D models, you know, at any semblance of quality and scale. And then, you know, kind of 2017, 2018, you started seeing, you know, a bunch of tools popping into the market, you know, Agisoft, you know, Metashape, Bentley has been in the space forever. And then I think really the democratization that happened was with this tool called Reality Capture, which Epic bought in 2020 or 2021, I believe. That was wild because it's like, hey, you can throw a bunch of images at it. And if you have an NVIDIA GPU, instead of taking like 4 or 5 hours, I used to let like Agisoft just run overnight to process my, you know, photogrammetry scans. And I was would always use a nice DSLR, to your point, like a mirrorless camera, at least 24 megapixels, you know, a wide angle, like 18 millimeter lens. And then when Reality Capture sort of came out, the speed got so much faster, the quality got better. I started using my iPhone a lot more, you know, and because the iPhones were getting better too. But yeah, you're totally right. Photogrammetry requires this like densely capture a space, right? Like to get anything resembling a good result. And there's sort of this like art to photogrammetry capture. Then enter neural radiance fields, right? And this has been really fascinating to me because it's like, to me, they solve slightly different problems, photogrammetry and neural radiance fields. And they've also developed in interesting ways, which is, you know, you had sort of like various approaches to doing view synthesis. So view synthesis in computer vision is the problem of like, given a bag of images, how do you create this representation that lets you, you know, generate intermediate viewpoints between all the images that you capture? Maybe even go outside the capture volume a little bit. And, you know, there was a bunch of interesting research coming out of Google and other places like this around like multi-plane images, where you could capture like a grid of images, right? Like a plane. And then you could kind of get that like little six-doff dance. This is the time where Facebook was also experimenting with 3D photos. If you remember, you just give them a single photo or take a photo with the depth sensor with the portrait mode on your iPhone that has a depth map and it would give you this parallax. And in parallel, academia was asking the question of, what if you had a bunch of those depth maps across a bunch of different viewpoints? Could you create a light field-like representation where you can really, really like capture the essence of a space and model all these view-dependent effects that photogrammetry struggles with, right? So photogrammetry, I describe it as like sort of like, it's like GTA, it's like this cardboard model, you know, it's like, it's awesome for measuring stuff, right? If you want to measure the freaking height of like a curb, amazing. You want to measure like a pole, like your building, the dimensionality for geometrically accurate measurements, fantastic. But if you've got anything like sort of in the world, you know, you and I are creating like awesome visuals, or if you care about cinematography, there's a lot of that information that gets lost in photogrammetry. So neural radiance field sort of took this like light fieldy approach, which was like super limited volume, to like, hey, what if we just like, you know, have an ML model, like look at a bag of images and create this, you know, volumetric representation, this true volumetric representation that encodes the complexity of reality into this, like the weights of this like multi-layer perceptron. And the results there were insane, right? Like suddenly you could have free viewpoint, like outside in captures became super viable. You didn't have to weave a bunch of these like pseudo light field things together with complex, you know, computer graphics and, you know, 3D engine optimizations. You got this like rather heavy, but beautiful looking, you know, volumetric representation where for every voxel in that 3D space, you had the, you know, the color values and also alpha values. And so that let this, you know, like this approach kind of model far more the complexity of reality. And that was like still took like 12 hours to train. Enter Instant NGP last year, like last summer-ish, which is when I really got excited about nerfs. Oh, now I can train it in like a minute on my GPU. So we're seeing this sort of like, you know, kind of a trend of like a new technique gets unlocked. It's a rather lofty, and then suddenly it gets optimized, and then four more folks start using. And then of course, you know, like recently, like Luma, you can do all of those things. Fast forward six more months on my freaking iPhone. I don't even need to like touch, you know, Python script or like go, you know, post things with Colmap. And it's just fascinating where this stuff is going. So that's where things are.
Well, let's come back to that. So first of all, we just ripped through a million tools. In the show notes, we're going to list all the things that you just mentioned so that people can look things up. The use of the words reality capture with photogrammetry, I think, is interesting and a good way to think of it, because you literally are capturing reality. You're going around, you're taking all the conceivable photos of every viewpoint that you can get of that object so that you actually get this model. The distinction with NERFs, which I think is interesting to think about, is it's kind of more of a close to reality capture, because it requires only a sparse set of photos. The idea is that it's reverse ray tracing, right? So in ray tracing, We project to the camera what the light would look like. With NERFs, we're kind of doing the opposite. We're getting photos, we're figuring out what the light was and kind of reversing into what the objects were. And a big part of generative AI is like filling in those gaps that we don't know about and having the computer figure out what those spaces are. You went off to a whole other piece, which is also the exponential improvement and now how those training algorithms are actually moving forward. But it seems like this is a huge improvement in the productivity on both of those dimensions. One, that I don't have to take 1,000 photos of a scene. I can get a few photos of the scene and start to get something that's pretty close. And the things that weren't exact are probably close enough to be used. And then also the rapid improvement with these tools like Luma that you were referring to, where it's going to capture it, do the training, and you get like these cinematic outputs right away.
I think you nailed it, right? It's also wild to imagine, like a sparser set of input imagery. So already it's like way more easy to capture than classical photogrammetry, where you want a lot of overlap to generate good depth maps. And at the same time, like have this AI model literally eyeball ray tracing kind of this inverse rendering problem and producing like amazing results. The fact that that works with such an elegant approach itself is amazing, right? And and you layer in now, you know, one of the other really awesome attributes of neural radiance fields is it does degrade a lot more gracefully than photogrammetry. So in photogrammetry, if you're generating these, like, you know, maybe you're using multi-view stereo to generate these depth maps, and then you create this dense point cloud, as you mentioned, and then you use like Poisson meshing and other techniques to make like continuous surfaces out of it, right? Like meshes have a hard time modeling a lot of complex stuff. Like, what do you do with a puddle? What do you do with glass? What do you do with reflections and specularities that are so important for all these types of use cases, whether that's like, you know, visual effects or whether that's even a virtual tour to just figure out what the vibe of a place is, right? And yeah, NERFs model that well. And I think you're taking this in a very interesting direction, that NERFs like already degrade gracefully. And then if you layer in perhaps these like new generative models, right? Could you fill in those holes in an even more elegant way? So eventually you're at this place where you only need to take like one or a couple of images, and then the rest is solvable because this model has seen the world and the complexity of the world, and it can fill in the gaps for you. So it's, I think reality capture is going to be this such like fundamental piece and primitive that we have to play with across a bunch of different use cases going forward.
So we're using the word reality. So I want to connect it to another reality, which is augmented reality, which you have a deep background in. And I want to kind of dream for a minute here, because I want to think about what happens when we go from the 10 hours to the 1 minute to the 1 second to the instantaneous. Maybe we will or won't get there, or maybe we'll get to kind of close enough. But when I look at your parents' room where you did that, I'm thinking, geez, what's that going to be like someday when I can put on my augmented reality glasses and just look around a room and say, hey, show me some different art along on the wall of my room. What do you think of that? Like, are we going to get there?
110%. I think that's a very compelling vision, right? It's like you're in real time reskinning reality, right? And what's fascinating to me is like, even with this example, right? Like you probably seen there's this like Qualcomm optimized Stable Diffusion to run on like a freaking Android smartphone with like, you know, a Qualcomm SoC, right? And then you just imagine Apple's ecosystem with their M series chips and like just the A series chips and just like the sheer compute that's on like, you know, some of these devices. I have no doubt that we'll get to a place where we could do this type of control net style taming diffusion with temporal coherence in real time. And, you know, it's like what's most fascinating to me is like it's almost sidestepping the classical AR platform, you know, play with AR Core and AR kits, right? It's like, you know, you don't have to do like crazy slam surface detection and all this other stuff. You're running like a basic, like, depth map estimation, and then you're just like plastering it on the world. And like, I'm excited to see how those like classical techniques that are very performant and run at 60 FPS on your device, and these some of these newer techniques, even in the near term, sort of have some like, you know, engage in some sort of holy matrimony, and like out comes this like, you know, just middle ground that's like a fertile playground for us to not have to do all the things you would have to do usually, right? Like, let's think about like the IKEA use case as an example. If you wanted to do that same reskinning, it's like, okay, so this like phone in your pocket needs to like understand all the geometry in a scene, then it needs to classify it. And then you've got to have like this backlog of 3D assets that somebody made, then you're placing them, then you're matching the lighting, and somehow these diffusion models kind of do all of that for you, right? Oh, it's like, hey, here's the rough 3D structure in a scene and like some of the edges, and it just like does everything for you and keeps the lighting consistent, which is just wild to me. Like, that's one of the first things that like blew my mind when I played with DALL-E 2 in painting. And I made a bunch of TikTok videos with this, like especially all my like UFO tests. It's like I had to go into Maya and like make this 3D model, and then I had to go find this like, you know, 360 HDRI, like this light probe to light the scene that kind of looked close enough. And I'd be sitting there tweaking dials, like just to get all the reflections to look light. And then I tried like, DALL-E 2 in painting for the first time. I was just like, you know, this is what I want. And I was like, holy crap, the lens flare is right. Holy crap, the shadow directions are light. Holy crap. Like all this, you know, it's like it understands the context of the scene and is able to sort of like, you know, a model those reflections, primary light directions, and, you know, the tonality and all this stuff that was manual goes from like 3-4 hours to 1 minute. And so like, yeah, you fast forward that to the AR world, and I think things are going to get absolutely wild.
There's a really interesting intersection around the way I might want to reskin reality around me, but at the same time, how other people want to project themselves into space. It seems like that's a lot of like the work you've done and everybody is kind of doing in platforms like Effect House doing AR. A lot of it is like, here's how I want to appear when I record a video and share it with my friends. I'm thinking a little bit about, well, sometimes I'm going to actually want to perceive the people around me the way I want to. And sometimes I'm going to want to put on, I don't know, a virtual fashion or something and appear in AR the way I want. I wonder how we're going to handle that intersection of technologies and, you know, creative fusion and whatnot.
I think it's a great question, right? It's almost like reality capture. You could decompose it roughly into the problem of like people, places, and things, you know? And there may be slightly different approaches to encapsulating the complexity of, say, a static environment or even a dynamic environment. You know, NVIDIA recently had this paper where it was trying to take NeRFs and go back to sort of this hybrid representation of, hey, here's this like explicit geometry. Because like, you don't need this like volumetric, you know, representation for a freaking flat surface. Let's just like make it flat. And then for really the complex stuff, let's use the benefits of this neural representation. I think in a similar fashion, the closest thing that comes to mind on humans is Meta's work on Kodak avatars, right? Which is, you know, again, right now, you know, they've shown like you need like a Paul Debevec style light stage, right? And he's done a bunch of great work at Google as well as Sharam Azadi's group with Project Holodeck, which showed you could create these relightable avatars too, with like really immaculate, you know, reproduction of what people are actually like. But it's interesting where like right now these systems are obviously at a place where you need these like super expensive multi-million-dollar capture rigs, right? But I think the same trajectory will apply. If you look at Kodak avatars, the idea is so cool, right? It's let's capture you once, and we capture you with all the various, you know, the smiles, all the expressions that, you know, the Hollywood world has been doing forever, right? With the really high-end performance capture for movies. And now we've got this like compressed Kodak avatar of you. So when you're having this type of a conversation, you know, maybe in 2D or 2.5D, and then eventually in like these 3D worlds, hey, we've got the avatar. All we need to send is like the performance capture data. And then we can sort of drive this puppet, if you will, and you could do interesting things there. And then just this past Meta, whatever their new version of like the Meta event is called, they showed that, hey, you could make a similar-ish avatar with just a phone. And so I think like given sufficient training data of enough diverse set of people in these capture stages and that getting like encapsulated in these models, and then just like simpler forms of capture with us, right? Like we're seeing this already with all like this whole wave of like Dream Booth popping out, and then Dream Booth plus Stable Diffusion, like web apps. And then like it's in Prisma and, you know, or Lensa, sorry. And you can just do really awesome, like make your avatar on demand. That's like a 2D static version of kind of that concept, right? And so in a similar fashion, you can imagine this sort of marriage happening. And then like recently, there was also this like last paper that came out with NeRF plus Instruct Picks to Picks, where you could type in a text prompt and restyle stuff, right? So John, to your point, if you then want to like, hey, I want to wear a tuxedo, or hey, I want to like style myself slightly differently, or I want to have like XYZ type of makeup on, right? You can prompt those things and sort of use the foundation of like, you know, your Kodak avatar, you know, which may be a hybrid neural representation plus whatever, and you could restyle it too. So I think like we're headed to like a very interesting future where all of these like sort of parallel versions will be possible. Like these parallel aesthetics would be possible for your context, right? Whatever context you're in. And it'll all be sort of powered by, you know, like similar building blocks. I don't think it's hard for me to imagine that fast forward 5 or 10 years and everyone has this like very firm sense of what their identity is. Like we're kind of doing this with Face ID already, but their identity, not just for like security and unlocking and authenticating that you're a human, but that becomes sort of your avatar, if you will, your personalized identity in various contexts.
I love that you mentioned Holodeck a little while ago. It's something that I've written a little bit. It's what I call the direct from imagination era, where we get to the point where if you can think of it, you can get it onto the screen. But what kind of goes hand in hand with what you were just talking about, what we were talking about, is the way as these things get closer and closer to real time, that it unlocks a lot of new use cases and applications. So like the idea of looking around your room and being able to reskin it with new art, new designs, which also makes me think that the Scandinavians and you know, other cultures which are kind of oriented around like these minimalist home decor environments, mm-hmm. are kind of onto something. Like you'll kind of start from minimalism and then project into all the complexity that you might want to change out from time to time. But yeah, the real-time aspect of it is what will really allow that to explode beyond sort of cool videos that we put up on Twitter and TikTok to, mm-hmm. now it becomes part of everyone's life. As I think about the holodeck, that's a real time activity. But it's also a social activity, right? People are going to actually do this with each other. So I'm imagining a day where we're kind of prompting different experiences into existence, not as individuals, but in groups where we kind of play with reality together and kind of construct things and reskin things and try things on as a social experience.
Wow. That's an interesting prompt. Where do you think that that's going to go? Because like one thing I think about a lot, maybe to reverse Uno and ask you a question here, is what happens to consumption experiences, both passive consumption of like, let's say Netflix and video, and also interactive experiences, right? Like a lot of people play games today. And it's like the question I've been asking myself, and I'd be curious to get your thoughts, is like, we've had this trend of like, Hollywood made a handful of movies, or game studios made a handful of games that everyone played. It was sort of one size fits all. And then this progression of like YouTube and then TikTok and on the video end, and then maybe things like Roblox and Minecraft on the 3D interactive end have sort of gone towards personalization, where there's many experiences and many, you know, videos and many like games that you can play versus these one size fits all, like me, I just play COD. It's the same game, slightly reskinned every goddamn year, but I still play it. But meanwhile, Roblox, there's like a bazillion games. It's largely UGC. So fast forward to what you're saying, what do you think happens to like consumption? Is everything hyper-personalized, or is there still going to be a space for sort of like these like one size fits all type experiences?
I think a lot of content will be highly personalized, but a big part of media consumption is the shared experience, the shared story. Mm-hmm. It's the fact that we can connect with each other because we both watched the Game of Thrones episode, and now we can talk about what happened in that, or the Star Trek episode, or whatever is really current at the moment. And that can occur at different levels. So it could occur across all of society, where we find these media artifacts, which we can talk about and connect with each other on, but it can occur at a micro level as well. So I'm thinking of like Dungeons and Dragons. So I kind of said like Dungeons and Dragons was like the first metaverse. Why do I say that? It doesn't require technology to have a metaverse. It just requires you to be able to go to this other plane of existence where you share imagination and storytelling, creativity with a group of people. And that's what D&D was. So the D&D group, which could be just 2, 3, 4, 5 people for a typical Dungeons and Dragons play group, was that idea of having a creative space where you share it together. But the meaningfulness of it is much greater because you're sharing it with other people. So I think that things like Roblox and Fortnite Creator Mode and all these new applications that are going to start integrating not only simplicity into the creative process, but generative AI technologies to allow you to bring in really interesting content, narrative, music, art, 3D models, etc. That's going to really accelerate things. I think that it's the most disruptive force that's going to happen in collaborative entertainment and video games and in anytime soon. And I think a lot of people who come from that Call of Duty building type of experience, I don't necessarily know that they all see it coming. That said, Call of Duty is probably valuable to you, not just because you like playing Call of Duty, but that's your thing. And you do it, and maybe you play with some other people that you know that you play Call of Duty with. So there's a social fabric around it that's super meaningful to you that isn't going to go away. So I don't actually buy the thesis that we're all going to be locked into our little VR worlds where we never emerge out, and it's hyper personalized and we don't, and I don't know, I guess in that version, people assume that we're dealing with virtual beings and AIs who become our friends. That could happen. I don't see a reason why it can't from a physics standpoint, but I think people are still going to really want to connect with each other. And it comes back to this notion of community. Like as creativity gets easier and easier and easier, the community and the shared consciousness, the shared experience is going to become more and more and more.
That deeply resonates with me. I think you nailed it with the community and the social fabric, right? Like I also, what I would add to that is like, I always think about, you know, since time immemorial, we've been sitting around the fireplace and telling ourselves these stories. And even if you look at, you know, various, you know, cultures, religious and spiritual traditions. It's the same sort of stories, the hero's journey, whatever you want to call it, like these same stories sort of like repeat themselves. And I think given that, and it's like, it's, you know, whether, what is the evolutionary, like, you know, sort of imperative of those type of stories is a separate discussion. But I feel like there's this innate need in us to have this sort of like shared communal conversation about, yeah, even passive experiences and certainly interactive. And I don't see that changing either. And certainly to your last point, I certainly hope that we don't end up in these like micro bubbles that are hyper personalized. And maybe that'll happen as well. But I have to hope that the predominant form of experience will be living, breathing, you know, humans interacting with other living, breathing humans with perhaps, you know, data to your, use your, you know, holodeck analogy, with other AI agents sort of in the group, right, that are like helping you have that shared experience or participating in it or augmenting your skills in interesting ways. And so I think some serious magic's going to happen there. And you're totally right. Nobody sees it coming. I wonder if Hollywood sees it coming, right? Like, it's like the monopoly on high-end production is going to be impacted. Now, at the same time, I always like to say, while an indie will be able to rival the output of a studio, what is like the Marvel Cinematic Universe going to do with this? That's going to be cool too. But I think gone are the days where something that is like substantially impressive in a passive consumption or interactive consumption medium is like made by just, you know, a handful of large companies. I think that those days are already numbered. And I think it'll be exciting to see how generative AI supercharges that.
You're one of the people that's building this kind of stuff. I feel like you're part of the wave that's coming, and you've done it at incredible scale. I think I read the other day that you hit the 100 millionth download on your AR filters on TikTok. And I also see all these UFO videos from you. You really like UFOs. What's going on with that?
I have just always been into X-Files and like Independence Day. And it's funny, the way I got into visual effects when I was a kid, so I got into 3D and VFX when I was 12 or 11. And back then on cable TV, on Discovery Kids, actually, there used to be this show called Mega Movie Magic. And I remember seeing like an episode on Independence Day, like the scene where they've got the mothership in New York and it just like, you know, just, you know, the rest. Exactly. And so they were showing how they were doing compositing there. And gosh, like that was just, to me, was like so much more exciting than any of like the Pixar Toy Story stuff. It was like, holy crap, you can blend reality and imagination in this crazy way using a computer. At that time, I was obsessed with Flash 5. That was like my 2D like animation thing. And this is like in the days, early days of the web, right? Shockwave was still predominant. Like I talk to kids now who have no idea about any of this stuff, or like, what, you didn't have Wi-Fi? And I just like, oh my God, dude. It's like, this ability to sort of combine reality and imagine really fascinates me. And so what are interesting ways to have you like believe something that doesn't exist? I think like monsters and UFOs are sort of this like sort of, you know, what is it called? Paranormal phenomena, or, you know, sort of this esoteric phenomena has been very fascinating to me. So yeah, that's been a theme through my content for the last couple of years. And it really hit off on TikTok right around, you remember when Raid Area 51 was happening? That like meme trend happened. It's right before the pandemic. And like, it was insane. Like that happened. And then just like all of these videos sort of took off. And yeah, I mean, even now, and then when the, like the DOD declassifications, whatever you want to think about, whether that's like some black budget project and it's the US trying to flex on China, whether that's some real phenomena, who knows? But well, you know, those things also like created a lot of interest around it. And certainly it's a topic that I've followed closely myself in my spare time. Yeah.
I'd like to learn a little bit more about your own journey as a creatorpreneur, which I'm sure. Not sure who invented that. Did you invent that term? That's a
cool word. But I blatantly copied it from a YouTuber by the name of Ali Abdal. It's the first time I saw it articulated like that, which is like the idea being you're a creator and you're an entrepreneur, and you focus on creating content that just like making, you like teaching, you like, you know, whatever, you want to make the movies you want to watch, the content you want to watch. But then you use that sort of organic distribution that you build to, you know, funnel in business opportunities, whether that's brand gigs, whether that's like teaching, whether that's digital products and services, whether that's, you know, even a startup. There's a bunch of people out there that are doing a really good job of sort of being a creator and being like a actual just like, you know, entrepreneur. So yeah, that's a shout out to Ali Abdaal for the creatorpreneur term.
You started out as a kid loving visual effects. Then you were, you know, then we'll jump forward a whole bunch of time. You were at Google, you were a product manager working on immersive technologies, AR, VR, kind of that universe of things. And then you got into all of this. What have you learned about that process? What words of wisdom would you share with anybody who wants to set out on that path?
I think you got to be passionate about something as a first and foremost thing. It's like the thing that I only realized recently is that, you know, gosh, I've had this exact passion since I was a kid and I kind of found it early. And, you know, I consider myself lucky because not everyone finds it. I love mentoring kids. Like I've certainly mentored a lot of aspiring product managers during my time at Google. And a lot of people are just like, they want to be the thing because that's the thing to be, if that makes sense. It's like, well, I just want to be a product manager because that's what you do. I don't, you know, like, I don't want to be an engineer. It's like, you know, like, and I don't want to be a program manager. I want to be a PM. You get to influence direction. It's like, but why? To what end? What kind of products do you want to work on? What are you passionate about? What kind of product manager or creator do you want to be? Because there's so many. It's like the colors of the rainbow. You can go into these roles being very different, right? Like, so I think me as a product manager, given my creator background and my passion for computer vision and 3D, is so different than, for example, somebody who went in deep into finance and has like a, you know, very detailed understanding of like, you know, it just sees the world in numbers, right? I see the world in pixels and voxels. And so I think people are different in that way. And so I think like everyone brings a unique perspective. So what I would share, especially with aspiring folks, is like, A, cultivate a passion, and be very open-minded about how that passion can be imbued and infused into whatever thing you do. When I was like 12, 13, watching all these like BTS, like, I never even saw like the Lord of the Rings movie end to end, but I saw all the behind the scenes featurettes on the VFX and what is Weta Digital doing and how did they do these like large scale, massive, you know, like, you know, battle simulations and all that type of stuff and distributed compute and how do they use Linux? That's the stuff that fascinated me. And it's funny, like, because all of that stuff in some, you know, shape or form, when I joined, you know, the AR VR teams and then the Maps teams at Google, that was exactly the thing that like we were doing. It's like if all the same stuff, except you're doing global scale 3D reconstruction of the world, a lot of the same problems, you know, perspectives just apply because there's so much overlap in these disciplines, you know, but for a while, especially I was in my early 20s, you know, like I had this feeling that, gosh, like I left my animation past behind. Like, so I ended up studying computer science and business. I wanted to go be a VFX supervisor at ILM and have a credit at the end of movies. That was the goal, you know, as a teenager. And then I just got more into the technical side of things. And for numerous reasons, like I ended up studying comp sci and business. And I'm actually glad I did that because after graduation, when I joined Deloitte in their emerging tech group, this is right when like Google Glass was a thing. I was like one of those like nerdy people that bought Google Glass like myself, just, I don't know why, but I did. And like, it was funny because all that VFX knowledge, After Effects, Maya still came in handy in UI and UX design. So I ended up doing a bunch of product design things. And so that kind of, you know, you expand into this sort of adjacent vertical and take advantage of the overlap. And then when VR really happened, that's when things got connected full circle with all the 3D stuff that I was doing. And then same thing with AR, because what is AR? To me, AR is running the visual effects pipeline in real time. That's what it is, right? Like you do exactly the same things. You capture a plate, you motion track it, you figure out where the geometry is, you place objects, you light it accurately, you composite things, you figure out haze, all these other things. And you're like creating a believable composite. That's what AR does at 60 frames per second. So what I would say is like, have a passion and be very flexible about how you infuse that passion into whatever it is that you're doing. And don't chase the title. Don't chase the role just because that's like the thing du jour to do, because there's always that thing, right? So now it's like prompt engineering. Like, don't get into prompt engineering because it's like prompt engineering, right? Or last year it was the metaverse. It's like everyone was in the metaverse. And it's like, hey, look, like, why do you want to be in the metaverse? That's a huge canvas. What do you want to bring to it? And I think that's where your interests like even musicians have found such a great space in things like VR, right? Like you think about all the awesome stuff like that's happening in like the DJing and real-time music concert space. So, and what like Golden Voice and Coachella is doing with all this stuff too. So that's what I'd say, have passions and infuse those passions into what you do. Don't chase titles. Don't chase like company names. Like, cause I think like, while that's awesome to do for a little while, at some point you got to find your like unique value proposition. And in this world of increasing commodification, that's going to become increasingly important.
Let's talk about what is also going to be increasingly important in the future. So talk about, you know, what scares you a little bit about the future, what concerns you about it, but more importantly, what excites you about the future that we're going into?
Hey, trust me, there's a lot that scares me. So we could go deep into that too. Here's the thing I truly worry about. I'll focus on the creation aspect of it, right? And we touched on a little bit with consumption experiences, right? There's this like, I think there's this very viable future where we are in our bubbles, right? Like, so I think it's very important for both creators and platforms to be very, very thoughtful about how they're building creation tools and consumption experiences that keep the creators and the viewers in mind. What do I mean by that? I think like a dystopian future to me is you've got this immaculately tuned TikTok style algorithm already, right? It's like this amazing interest-based graph thing, and it knows your interest better than you know yourself. It knows what content to feed you to get you engaged and stay there, right? These bite-sized pieces of content. Oh, we just don't need creators anymore. Let's just have like fully generative stuff. There's just like little Michaela's on steroids or a bunch of virtual influencers. And the feed that you get is just exactly what you need to optimize engagement. And if we take a function like that with like engagement optimization, especially with where we're going with technologies, we've already seen what damage that can do. Certainly it does a lot of good too, but the damage it can do when you take these very narrow AI systems and make its objective to, in quotes, optimize engagement, it can result in disastrous consequences. It really having a psychological impact on people too, right? Whether that's the Instagram era or the TikTok era, whatever it is, you know, that's always been the case. And so I think very deeply about like, even as a creator, how do you think about generative AI as a tool not to like, just think about the insane pace of content lately, right? Like there was the thing with YouTube where it's like, yeah, I make a YouTube video a week. Maybe I make it like, you know, once every 2 weeks or every month, a 10-minute video takes a long time to produce. And then with TikTok, you know, I love Gary Vee, you know, like I had a chance to meet him. Awesome dude. But he's like, yo, you got to make 7 TikToks a day, just every day. You just got to be dishing out content every single day. Now you pour gasoline with generative AI, there's a world in which we're like, actually, instead of now automating my 7 pieces of content away so I can focus on the creative vision and the artistic side, let's actually crank out 50 pieces of content a day and just like inundate. Oh gosh, it's a gold rush. There's this like limited window right now, right? Like, and so I deeply worry about that, both on the creator side, that we take advantage of these tools to like automate the drudgery and focus on, you know, what makes us unique, our creative vision, our ability to orchestrate these tools and systems. And so the creation tools also need to keep in mind not to replace that, which is why I think like people reacted very adversely to text to image. But then as things like ControlNet started popping up that gave artists more control, more artists got excited about it than they had been in the past. Cause it's like, oh, this thing, like I learned how to do like line work, you know, with a Wacom tablet and Photoshop or Procreate. Oh, and now this tool can just do like the painting, like the coloring for me. Whoa, that's awesome. Oh, I can take my artwork and turn into this like 3D looking thing. That gets people excited. So I think it's very important. Consumption platforms are mindful of like, hey, let's just not crank the dial on optimizing engagement, because not only do you have a supercomputer pointed at your head now, you've got these systems that can create content, not just target and match you with content. And I think like, there's a world where like, gosh, another dystopian scenario to me is like, maybe this could be done tastefully too, again, right? Like, I'm sure there's somebody working on this. You're watching that Netflix movie, right? Like you're sitting down with your family, your partner, or whatever, your friends, and you're having a conversation saying, hey, I want to watch Spider-Man based in Mumbai, directed by J.J. Abrams. You say that. And then everyone's got their like, you know, you got your Whoop on, like somebody else has got their Apple Watch on. And then the biometric feedback is literally doing retention editing in real time. So now you don't need Mr. Beast editor. This like dynamic responsive piece of content is reacting to you in real time to keep you engaged. that's a lot of power, right? And that can go in bad directions too, right? So like, those are things I think about. It's like the creation tools company, the creators themselves, and the distribution platforms all need to be very careful about sort of like how we go about integrating these technologies. Because I think the future of creative self-expression and the future of consumption and the joy of consumption is sort of hangs in the balance.
The platforms often get a lot of flack over the algorithms and sort of the addictive loop, whether it's Netflix binging or just sitting there in front of TikTok. Although, you know, like a lot of things, there are good aspects of it too. Like when I go to TikTok and I want to learn something, if I want to learn like all the things I can do with garlic, there's someone who will tell me that.
It's wild, right?
And I'll get a lot of information about that. If I'm really curious that day about, you know, AR and VR and who's done some really interesting work in that, there's definitely someone there. So it isn't all about just sort of trapping you in the loop. There's a learning aspect, which I think that people who don't use TikTok actually don't actually appreciate some of that. They kind of hear secondhand, like about the loop, but without the benevolent aspects of it.
It's dumbing the population. Oh my God, the Tide Pod Challenge. And I think you're right, right? Like it is, again, like AI itself is technology is such a double-edged sword, right? And I think you're totally right. I think to give TikTok credit, because like there's a reason YouTube Shorts, Instagram Reels, everyone pretty much, even Netflix has this like, just like TikTok style feed where you can trickle through content, right? What they got right was this like interest-based graph, to your point about the garlic and the AR/VR, right? It's like the social graph kind of stoked this like, you know, thou shalt not covet your neighbor type thing. Like that thing kind of came out front and center with like, oh my God, this person has like a Bentley. Oh, I need to go get a Bentley now or whatever. That's sort of like, oh, like so-and-so from high school is doing so well. Like, oh, like am I in the best, you know, it kind of forced you to compare with this like highly curated best representation of people. And again, God bless those platforms too, right? Because like I'm connected with so many of my friends from like my time in India that I wouldn't have been if not for Instagram DMs and Facebook Messenger, right? It's wild. So I think that's there too. But the interest-based graph that TikTok nailed, where there was this like, here's this massive pile of content and let's actually do a really good job of like connecting a massive audience to it. It almost like, and then lowering the stakes for creation, which is I think also just like a masterstroke, which is why I got into it. Like, I've been working, I've like been, you know, like toiling away on YouTube since 2016 and I really got into TikTok 2020, like along with a lot of other people. And gosh, it was so much easier for me to create even 15-second pieces of content. But then the audience was like right there, right? Like you'd find that audience, which is like still amazing. You could still do that on TikTok. And so it incentivized more people to create too, which is a good thing in my opinion, right? It's like on YouTube, classical YouTube, Shorts has obviously changed the dynamic. Like less than 1% of like users on the platform made content because there was this barrier to entry. And now enter TikTok where it's 15 seconds, all on your phone, all this other stuff, like 40, 50%. I forget the exact statistic. You should look this up, but it's like a disproportionate amount of people actually create a TikTok video, which is wild, right? And so it solves the blank canvas problem and they've created just this beautiful flywheel and it's no surprise that every other platform is copying it. So I think there's certainly a space for all of that. And with anything good, there's always bad, right? The answer always lies in the balance. I like to say it's like walking on the edge of a sword. It's really hard to walk there, but if you can manage to do it, oh my God, like that's where we'll get the best, we'll optimize the benefits and minimize the downsides.
I'm going to close on what I'm hopeful about in the future. And I'd love to hear your own version of this as well. But when we talk about these algorithms, it's just important to remember that the numbers that these platforms are optimizing around really ultimately come down to their revenue, their EBITDA, things like that, which, you know, is why they want to drive retention and keep you on the platform. I'm hopeful that in the future, as AI becomes more and more democratized, that it could actually bring power back to individual creators and individual users on these platforms. I'm imagining a future where we have our own personalized intelligent agent that optimizes on the metrics we actually care about, and we're building our own things and training our own models. So that I think will unlock a future which is more about bringing the power back to the people, us, to actually be able to do what we want, guided by our own personalized objectives. And then these AIs exist to sort of amplify our will on the metaverse, if we want to call it that. So that's what I want to build. By the way, it's not a prediction, it's a hope. These are things that actually have to be built. Like, totally, and this is going to be a tension between those who will want centralized control and keeping the AI inside behind, you know, API wrappers versus those like me who would like to see more of this land on my personal computer. What are your own thoughts? And it doesn't have to be about that, but just generally about the future. What are you hopeful for? What do you want to see built?
I would like to react to what you're saying, because you're bringing up some interesting points. It's like, this sort of tension between sort of centralization and, you know, aggregation of more power than perhaps, you know, Orwell's wildest imaginations, right? Like, that's certainly a path. And there's also this point of like, personalized AIs, right? Like, I'm really hopeful to see what Apple does in this regard, right? Like, we trust Apple with so much data, and they talk about the secure enclave. They've already got Face ID. They've already got a bunch of other pieces here, but I think make it very, very interesting to see how can you make this like personalized assistant. And then you've got like sort of like Imad and Stability's point of view, which is like, hey, not just like your personalized model that you can access, but like, here's your model and you have access to the weights for that model too, right? Like the complete control. And so the future I see is kind of like the future we're in right now, where it's like, yes, and all of those things. I think there's an immense space and place for centralization. I'll give you an example. I think GPT-4 multimodal capabilities should not be open sourced, and the weight should not be open. I think that's like unleashing too much power too quickly upon the world before we have time to adapt, right? Like, we need to be cognizant of the fact that policy and institutional framework is not going to keep up at the same rate of technological innovation. It's just not. It's like, these are legacy institutions, right? And so like, you know, then insert like, I don't know, like, you know, the decentralized like crypto stuff that, you know, Balaji and all these folks talk about, like the decentralized like country, right? How do you imagine like a government that's like, you know, completely decentralized? And again, I imagine there will be the yes ands of the world. China's going to look very different than America does. Europe's going to probably look different than even America does. Already look at the differences between GDPR and what we've got going on in the US. And I think it'll be a situation of yes and, where there are certain models that are totally going to be open. So for example, I think we should keep like image generation models completely open. The way it should be out there. I think we can solve the synthetic deepfake problem. I think we can, it'll be the next evolution of how we deal with like vulnerability management and patching zero day exploits and all this type of stuff. We can play that game of whack-a-mole, I think. But these more powerful generalized systems, and I get squeamish even when I see some of the auto GPT stuff, to be honest, because it's just so like, it's like this kind of like, it's in its infancy, right? And so then you imagine, oh yeah, you got auto GPT with multimodal, like, you know, capabilities. This is going to be far beyond solving a CAPTCHA, you know, like that's like scratching the surface. We're talking about like, literally you could build Big Brother in a box, right? And I wrote a thread on this where like, how an influencer was geolocating people using public camera feeds and their Instagram, like their geotagged Instagram posts, and was able to figure out at what time did this influencer visit this location. And that type of pattern of life analysis has only been accessible to the intelligence community, right? Do we really want power like that, where you can parse social feeds, image data, like out completely in the wild? I don't think humanity is ready for that. But I think humanity is totally ready for like content generation models. Like, I think that problem is solvable. So I think it's like this very nuanced discussion, which is why you see a lot of tension right now, the 6-month pause and not to pause or not to pause. And like many things in today's society, it becomes exceedingly polarized. And it's like, you know, one extreme and the other extreme. And I think, again, the answer is always in the balance. So that's my reaction to the future. I think it'll be all of the above. What am I excited about? I am most excited about, like, holy crap, content creation has been this, like, to go back to where I started, this ill-tailored tapestry of these specialized tools, right? Like, there's so many tools, you know, I don't know if you read my tweet thread on Wonder Dynamics, where there's this like iceberg visual of like just all the tools you have to play with, right, to make stuff happen. God, the cognitive load you have to deal with to do that. And it makes perfect sense if you're doing a big Hollywood production or like a Netflix thing where you've got specialized talent. Hey, I'm a modeler, I'm a rigger, I'm a texturing artist, right? Like, I'm an animator, you know, I'm like good at compositing. where those specialized roles made sense. But in this future where like indies and small groups of people are empowered to create, I'm so excited that there's this time where we can like sort of create these tools that are sort of these all-in-one hubs, or with just a confluence of a couple of tools, we can replace what previously required thousands of dollars of licenses and massive, like, you know, render farms, and all of that capability is getting democratized. So I'm excited to see both what happens on the indie end and the high end when it comes to the implications of these technologies. And also AR, VR, right? Like, I think AR, VR sort of become like a bad word this year because metaverse and, you know, the Web3 stuff or whatever, right? Like, it's going to be back. Like, generative AI is the way you populate, in quotes, the metaverse. So I think that stuff's going to be out there. And some of the stuff, you know, like even some of my work at Google and some of the work that all these companies have been doing to lay these primitives in place. So like the geospatial API, visual positioning service, in 100 countries, you could go right now, look up AR Core Geospatial API. You can download this like free, you literally for free, you could create an AR experience that you can like anchor and localize content in 100 countries and not just figure out exactly what your phone is, but the 3D geometry of everything around you and start annotating and reskinning it. The marriage of that stuff plus generative, oh my God, I cannot wait to see what happens there. And so like all these primitives are being layered up, and like there's almost like we're stacking these waves of innovation. And so I'm just excited to see where all that goes, specifically on this like creation end, both for passive content and for interactive content.
Generative agents, we're going to discover what the issues are there. No doubt the most immediate problems are going to be the ones caused by humans and what they direct them to do. And those are risks that we've definitely got to take seriously, just as like deep fakes are already a problem. And we're going to have to figure out how to stamp those with authenticity codes or cryptographic signatures or whatever it is. We got to figure out how to solve some of these problems before they become a complete mess, which they're kind of on their way to becoming. But on the positive side of things, the idea of starting to take all of these specialist tools, putting them together into cohesive creative pipelines that anybody can use so that you can really get the ideas out of your head and onto a computer and then share it with a community of people that love what you do. That's what's exciting here. And Lavel, thanks so much for being here to talk to me about this. I think we could talk about this for hours. Amen, and maybe we'll talk again about generative agents, since that's the next big thing and we're not too sure where that's going yet.
Totally. Yeah. You should train a generative agent with all your tweets, you know, and just like, it'd be interesting to conduct a podcast interview. It's like take an interviewee and the interviewer and just like, yeah, stage them up to have this conversation. Just like, it'd be interesting to see what happens. But thank you so much for having me, John. Pleasure to be here. And I look forward to our future conversations.